Now I am standing on the pavement in a garden. It is a pavement garden, for the florist puts her plants out here, disciplined ranks of them, but hopeful plants, aspiring, because it is bedding plant time, in other words, late spring. Not long ago, just where I stand, marked the end of London. I know this because an old woman told me she used to take a penny bus here from Marble Arch every Sunday. That is, she did, quote, "If I had a penny to spare, I used to save up upon my dinners. I used to look forward all week. It was all fields and little streams. We took off our shoes and stockings and sat with our feet in the water and looked at the cows. They used to come and look at us. And the birds, there were plenty of those. That was just before the First World War, in that period described in books of memoirs as a golden age. Yet you can find in stationers' counters postcards made from photographs of this street 100 years or so ago. It has never not been a poor street, and it is a poor one now. Even in this particular age of peace and plenty, not much has changed, though shop fronts are flashier and full of bright, cheap clothes, and there is a petrol station. The postcards show modest, self-regarding buildings, and the ground floor of every one is a shop of long since extinct, where each customer was served individually. Outside them, invited from behind a counter or center to the picture, stand men in bowler hats or serving aprons. If it is a woman, she has a hat on of the kind that insisted on obdurate respectability, for that is a necessary attribute of the poor. But only a couple of 100 yards northwest, my friend sat on Sundays with her feet in the little stream while the cows crowded close. Oh, it was so cold, she remembered. The water take your breath away, but you'd soon forget that, and it was the best day of the week. A few 100 yards north, there used to be a mill. Another woman, younger than the first, told me she remembered that mill. Mill Lane. The name's there because it used to be a mill, you see. But they pulled the mill down. And where it was is a building no one would notice if you didn't know what it replaced. If they had let the mill stand, we would be proud of it. They would charge us to go in and see how things used to be. I enter the station, buy a ticket from a machine that works most of the time, and go up long stairs. At the station, you stand to wait for trains on a platform high above roofs, and the treetops are level with you. You feel thrust up into the sky, the sun, the wind, the rain arrive unmediated by buildings. Exhilarating. That's from London Stories, and more particularly from an essay that Doris Lessing wrote in 1992 entitled In Defense of the Subway. It's about London, about the city of London. Whether you've ever visited or have never, I'll wager you nonetheless have an immediate mental view of that super-sized city. London's been the setting of so many fictional and non-fiction tales and events for centuries. It can be found far away from our Atlantic shores, but the city of London has been a part of the American experience, in fact, and in fiction, since well before the nation was formed. Today's book does not take us back to the prehistory of the town, whose name is most likely derived from its establishment by an ancient Roman military base among the Britons. But the sweep of the stories and the essays in this book is breathtaking nonetheless, opening with a graphic, stinging travelogue of sorts of the city of London when it was in the midst of being visited with a medieval plague. Our guide to the gore and the hopeless sense of living is Thomas Dekker, writing from 1603. We catch up next with Daniel Defoe and his childhood life as a self-described youthful rogue. A more chuckle-filled essay you'll rarely enjoy, but amongst the chuckles, Defoe delivers to us a clear sense of early 1700s London, known even then as one of the biggest cities in London, as a city where Dickensian and Darwinian mores were the norm of the day, when orphan kids, like Defoe, were left on their own devices to survive, and if they were crafty or lucky, maybe even thrive, such as thrive could mean, at a time when the American colonies were still a backwater part of the mighty British Empire. On and on the years pass by, and author after author write to us of the steadfastness, the long-enduring, what used to be called the plucky tales of the working poor of London and of the garishly bright city lights of the rich. And then we come to the master of English himself, a short story penned by none other than Charles Dickens, who uses the English of his day to literally paint a muted picture of life on the deep of the River Thames, flowing through the center of that great city. One of my favorite Sherlock Holmes tales makes the cut, The Tale of the Blue Carbuncle, a tale of Christmas goose, and the repartee of Holmes and Watson. We jump into the 20th century with George Gissing Christopherson's tale, opening the new century of the 1900s with the words, "It was 20 years ago, and on an evening in May. All day long there had been sunshine, owing, doubtless, to the incident I am about to relate. The light and warmth of that long-vanished day lives with me still. I can see the great white clouds that moved across the strip of sky before my window and feel again the spring languor that troubled my solitary work in the heart of London town." The sad but ultimately inspiring tale of Merrick, the Elephant Man, written in 1923, tells us that the 20th century did not do away with London's penchant for inspiring a milieu of the well-off versus the working poor. But the essay certainly does point to the opportunity for empathy to triumph in the midst of urban squalor, at least sometimes. Graham Greene, who happens to be one of my favorites, offers a fittingly damp, depressed, and yet beautifully written short mystery to the collection. It was written and published on the eve of the disaster that was World War II, and it is titled A Little Place Off the Edgware Road. And so it is, too, that the later 20th century features That Defense of the Underground, penned by better known as a mystery writer Doris Lessing. Britain, after all, is nothing in the modern pop culture world if not a land of detectives and villages. And the wonder of it all is that the British have a smooth ability to make that mega city of London become perceived more as a landscape of small village neighborhoods than gritty New York or Tokyo, both megacities as well. I hope that that opening reading from Doris Lessing, talking about the neighborhood in which she caught the underground on a regular basis, kind of fits that in. She's talking more of a small London in the midst of that huge megacity than she is talking about London sprawling over miles and miles and miles. We wrap up this very readable collection, this bouquet of literary love for London, with not only Lessing, but a couple of other responses to the increasing multicultural makeup of London City, if not the British Isles. And while I'm not sure that London has the greatest literary tradition of any city in the world, as our introduction tells us, I think we can all agree with the introduction that the city's roll call of storytellers includes cultural giants like Shakespeare, Defoe, Dickens, and an innumerable host of writers of all sorts who sought to capture the essence of the place, and I would argue continue to do so. One final note, the grammarian will delight in the various changes written English has pursued over the years, from A Visit to Charlotte Xibber, which is full, I tell you, of exclamation points. It's hard to read a sentence in that story without seeing an exclamation point, written in 1795, to the run-on sentence structure of De Quincey's Anne of Oxford Street, from a mere 20 years hence, in 1822 after the Napoleonic Wars. Some of my high school English teachers would have paled to read De Quincey, and probably did when they were in college, to read De Quincey's run on and on and on and on sentences, kind of a format I personally prefer. I want to end, though, with a little bit from Charles Dickens, who wrote this beautifully descriptive tale of the River Thames. In 1853, it's titled Down with the Tide. This is a little bit from the opening. I hope you, too, can enjoy the moody sense that Dickens gives us of that great river running through London town. He writes, "A very dark night it was, and bitter cold. The east wind blowing bleak and bringing with it stinging particles from marsh and moor and fen. From the great desert and old Egypt, maybe. Some of the components, parts of the sharp-edged vapor that came flying up the Thames at London, might be mummy dust, dry atoms from the Temple of Jerusalem. camel's footprints, crocodile's hatching places, loosened grains of expression from the visages of blunt-nosed sphinxes, waifs and strays from caravans of turbaned merchants, vegetation from jungles, frozen snow from the Himalayas. Oh, it was very dark upon the Thames, and it was very bitter, bitter cold. "And yet," said the voice within the great peacoat at my side, "you'll have seen a good many rivers, too, I dare say." "Truly," said I, "when I come to think of it, not a few. From the Niagara downward to the mountain rivers of Italy, which were like the national spirit, very tame, or chafing, suddenly in bursting bounds, only to dwindle away again. The Moselle and the Rhine, and the Rhone, and the Seine, and the Saône, and the St. Lawrence, the Mississippi, the Ohio, and the Tiber, the Po and the Arno, and the..." Peacoat coughing as if he had had enough of that. I said no more. I could have carried the catalogue on to teasing length, though, if I had been of a cruel mind. "And after all," he said, "this looks so dismal." "So awful," I returned, "at night. The Seine at Paris is very gloomy, too, at such a time, and is probably the scene of far more crime and greater wickedness. But this river, the Thames, looks so broad and vast, so murky and silent, seems such an image of death in the midst of the great city's life that..." The peacoat coughed again. He could not stand my holding forth. We were in a four-oared Thames police galley, lying on our oars in the deep shadow of Southwark Bridge, under the corner arch on the Surrey side, having come down with the tide from Vauxhall. We were fain to hold on pretty tight, though close to shore, for the river was swollen and the tide running down very strong. We were watching certain water rats of human growth, and lay in the deep shade as quiet as mice, our light burden and our scraps of conversation carried on in whispers. Above us, the massive iron girders of the arch were faintly visible, and below us its ponderous shadows seemed to sink down to the bottom of the stream. Every color but black seemed to have departed from the world. The air was black, the water was black, the barges and bulks were black, the piles were black, the buildings were black, the shadows were only a deeper shade of black upon a black ground. Here and there a coal fire in an iron cresset blazed upon a wharf, but one knew that it too had been black a little while ago and would be black again soon. Uncomfortable rushes of water, aggressive and gurgling and drowning, ghostly rattlings of iron chains, dismal clankings of discordant engines formed the music that accompanied the dip of our oars and their rattling in the rowlocks. Even the noises had a black sound to me, as the trumpet sounded red to the blind man. Just some of the great writing about London. That, of course, from Charles Dickens, Down with the Tide in 1853, in a collected group of stories and essays entitled London Stories. It's part of the Pocket Classics from Everyman's Penguin Editions, and it's available at all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.